I'm Terrence McNally, and welcome to another episode of Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work. I'll be speaking today with Charlotte Alter, national correspondent for Time magazine, about her first book, The Ones We've Been Waiting For, How a New Generation of Leaders Will Transform America. And you can learn more at charlottealter.com. That's Charlotte, the way you'd expect it, and then A-L-T-E-R, charlottealter, one word, .com. After a three-year hiatus since Trump's Electoral College victory, I've been doing a new interview every other week. Paul Hawken on climate change, Naomi Klein on why no is not enough, Arlie Hochschild on her book Strangers in Their Own Land and the Stories That Divide Us, Nick Kristof and Cheryl Wu Dunn on the deaths of despair in their book Tightrope. The shows air on KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles and stream weekly on the Progressive Voices Network on TuneIn. Podcasts are available anytime, anywhere, on Apple Podcasts, most major podcast sites, and at my site, terrencemcnally.net, TerrenceMcNally.net. Now, I always like to plug participation. Some organizations I've been flagging for you is indivisible.org, an organization that started after Trump's election. They've got at least 5,000 local chapters, and we'll send you an email every week telling you relevant and timely actions you might want to take and pay attention to. Two digital organizations that since Trump's election have been working more closely with grassroots organizations on a national level, moveon.org, and in California, Courage Campaign, one word, .org. A couple that keep you in touch with your representatives is 5Calls, the number 5 and the word calls, 5Calls.org, which tells you the timely and relevant calls you might want to make on issues and legislation. And Town Hall Project, one word, townhallproject.com, which tells you when your representative will be holding meetings locally, which, of course, will not be happening during the pandemic. But keep that in mind for when things open up again. And then I always like people, if climate change is your issue, 350.org. This being an election year, I also encourage you to get involved, not only with campaigns, but with the efforts to fight voter suppression and assure that all Americans get their right to vote, as if the future depends on it, which, of course, it does. And if you saw what happened in Wisconsin recently, this is going to be a fight. It's not going to be this 2020 election will not just be decided based on who people would like to vote for, who people would choose to vote for, but whether or not they get to vote and whether or not their votes get counted. And now, as we are confronting the coronavirus pandemic, I encourage you also to do your part in facing that pandemic by social distancing and in looking for ways to help those in your local community hurt most by the social isolation and the economic devastation now unfolding. One idea that people have is, you know, buy some gift cards. And when that person checks you out at the grocery store, most grocery stores won't let you tip, but if you hand them a gift card, I think they'll accept it. With gloves, of course. Now to today's conversation. There are now 26 millennials in Congress, and that is five times as many as before the 2018 midterms. Time magazine national correspondent Charlotte Alter, responsible for a lot of cover stories, including profiles of Pete Buttigieg, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, the young leaders of March for Our Lives, and the Person of the Year story recently on Greta Thunberg and climate change. Well, she also is a millennial. And she says that when Trump was elected, she realized she was not going to be the one to write the big Trump story. So she started looking around at who might be up and coming among her peers. And as we'll talk about, she got there early with a lot of them, early, before they were national names, before they maybe had been elected even. In what is her first book, The Ones We've Been Waiting For, How a New Generation of Leaders Will Transform America, she examines how millennials have gained power so far, what were their paths, how did they do it, from City Hall to Congress. And she's really looking to see what America might look like once they're in charge. And I know it's not all about the president, but let me point out that so far, the three boomers, my generation, have been two of the worst, and one who wasted his considerable gifts on neoliberalism. And the boomer elected this fall, whether Biden or Trump, will be the last. Millennials have already revolutionized technology, commerce, and media, and they're responsible for the major social movements of our time. So how are we going to get to that political future, and what is it going to look like when we do? Charlotte Alter is a national correspondent, as I said, for Time magazine, covering the 2016, 2018, 2020 elections, women in politics, the rise of the grassroots left, activism around gun violence and climate change. Her work has also appeared in the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, and as I said, the ones we've been waiting for is her first book. Welcome, Charlotte Alter, to Freeform, A World That Just Might Work.
Terrence, thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to be here.
Very good. And let me tell listeners, we're recording this conversation Friday, April 24th. First of all, how are you doing? Where do you live? What's the pandemic like where you are? How are you coping? It's a tough time to promote your first book.
Yeah, you know, I'm okay. I mean, the book came out February 18th, so I was lucky that, you know, it was before a lot of things were shut down, although, of course, now we all wish that it had been shut down sooner, but I got to do a little bit of book promotion beforehand. I live in Brooklyn with my husband, and we're in good shape. We're pretty lucky that we, you know, are employed, and we have enough food, and we have enough supplies, and, you know, it is a good, we have a lot of friends and family who are dealing with little kids right now, and that's not the stage we're in yet, so it's kind of nice to not be in that stage yet.
Yes.
Yeah. So, but it is a little spooky in Brooklyn because there's just a lot of sirens every day, every night, all through the day, all through the night. We live near one of the big hospitals that's been kind of at the center of the pandemic. So what about you? Are you holding up okay?
Yeah, I'm in Long Beach, California. I lived in LA from 75 until 2017. And my wife and I moved down to Long Beach, about 35 miles from the center of LA to be closer to her mom. Her mom's 89. And was the three-time mayor of Long Beach. So that's, she's really probably our biggest concern. And, you know, since I work from home, I sort of say there are lots of time when it feels like nothing has changed. And then there are times when it feels like everything's changed.
Yes, that is true. That is certainly true.
So I like people to get a feel for the folks behind the work and the ideas that we talk about. So let us know a bit about yourself. How do you see your path to the work that you do today? And you can go way back, mentors, childhood inspirations, turning points, moments of decision, anything along that way.
Yeah, I mean, I'm pretty lucky. My father is also a journalist. His name is Jonathan Alter.
So and let me cut in for 1 second. I have interviewed your father a couple of times.
Yeah.
Most recently, I think on his on the Franklin Roosevelt book.
Yes. Yes.
Which
a great book to read right now, particularly
yes.
if we're talking about big government intervention to help. You know, alleviate what could be another depression. So.
Yes, yes. And so it's when I first saw your name, I went, "Is he old enough to have this daughter?"
Yeah, he
and
is.
Then I checked, and yes, he was. So give him my best.
Yeah. I will. So I was very lucky that I kind of grew up around that, and I understood the rhythms of journalism, and you know, I honestly didn't really think that I wanted to be a journalist when I was growing up. And then I sort of accidentally got into it because it was the only job I could find that would pay me to write, which is what I wanted to do. And I started off, doing news aggregation, which is kind of the new entry-level job in journalism where you just write these like 200-word stories about aggregation. And then I was writing a lot about feminism in 2014 and 2015. And then Hillary Clinton was running for president, and I said, you know, I write about women. This is one of the biggest women's stories of all time. I have to cover this. So,
and were
I
you
sort of,
were you already at Time at that point?
I was at Time. Yeah, they had sort of relaunched their site, so I was one of the people. That's what I was doing. basically. I was helping them build their digital content, and that was my job. So then I was sort of, I covered 2016. I was a very junior reporter on the political team covering 2016. And then after Trump was elected, it really seemed like every other reporter in the country was just fully focused on Trump and his White House and this incredibly, unusual and dysfunctional administration. And there was a new scandal every week, and the entire press corps was laser focused on that. And it doesn't help, by the way, that I live in New York and most political journalists live in DC. So I immediately knew that, I was just never gonna be the reporter that was gonna get, leaked secret documents from the intelligence committee about Russia. Like, I didn't have the sourcing for that. I knew that there were many really smart reporters who were chasing those stories, and that they were gonna help us through, they were gonna guide us through what that meant. But I also knew that there were tons of smart, young, interesting people out there in the country getting involved in politics, and nobody was paying attention to them. And I first started thinking about this, when I noticed that all these young women, not even young women, just women in general, were stepping up to run for Congress, after Trump was elected. And so one of the first stories I wrote about this wave was this story in 2017 called, sorry, 2018 called The Avengers, where it was about all these women who stepped up to run for office. So I've kind of, carved out a beat for myself that was sort of like about the up-and-comers who aren't necessarily in the spotlight, but still matter a lot in our political process, even though they're not in Washington yet.
Okay, and so now let's talk about the book. You were writing, as I pointed out, cover profiles and so on. These are pretty much the long reads in a magazine like Time. And yet this is your first book. When did you decide, and how did you decide this is a book?
So I decided to write this book, or I decided to start thinking about this as a book on the day that Trump withdrew from the Paris Climate Agreement, which was in 2017, the spring of 2017. And on that day, I got extremely angry. Right now I'm 30. Back then I was 27. And I saw a 71-year-old impetuously withdraw from this international agreement that was seemed like the last best hope for my kids and grandkids to live on a livable planet. And then when I looked around a little further, I realized, as I had seen during the 2016 election, that, Trump was elected overwhelmingly by older white voters, and that the Congress who supported him at that time was, the median age in that Congress was the oldest that it had been since the 1980s, and the 22 senators who wrote him a letter encouraging him to withdraw from the Paris Climate Agreement had a median age of 64, including five octogenarians. So it just became really clear to me that that was the moment when he withdrew from the Paris Climate Agreement. That was the moment I realized this was a government of old people, by old people, and for old people. And I just was like, this can't last forever.
Yeah,
You
no,
know,
but
this
you know
is,
what's interesting when you say that is that all of those things were true up until, the day before he withdrew. And it's interesting how that event said, wait a minute, how, this is my life, this is my kid's life, this is my grandkid's life. Who are these people?
And then as soon as I started thinking about it that way, I began to see a lot of the other actions of the Trump administration within that context. Like, for example, canceling DACA is something that disproportionately affects young people, right? Banning trans soldiers from serving in the military is something that there aren't a whole lot of 60-year-old trans military officers, right? That is definitely a poke in the eye to young people. Gutting the federal agency that regulates predatory student loan lenders, that is a that is a smack in the face to young people. So the more I thought about it, the more everywhere I looked, I saw that this was an administration whose policies were disproportionately affecting young Americans.
You know, I'd even when I was reading these thoughts in your work, I thought, you know, this also applies to most of his worst anti-immigration things.
Yes.
It is not people in their 60s who migrate 1,000 miles to get to the U.S.
Yes.
These are usually fairly young families. And when he's pulling children, or he's having his agents pull children from the arms of their parents, those are young people and their kids.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. And not to mention that the tax cut, the 2017 tax cut, is going to leave my generation with trillions of dollars of federal debt to pay off. You know,
yeah.
So anyway, the more I thought about it, the more I began to see this administration in that context, and it became, you know. But then I was kind of thinking, okay, this is definitely a book, but I don't really want to write a manifesto because mm-hmm. I don't like reading manifestos. And, you know, who does? Who's like, yes, a manifesto, must read. So I decided instead that I would write a book that was sort of, you know, operating under the idea that this too shall pass, which it will, you know.
Yeah,
This too shall pass. So who is coming up next? What does the rising generation believe? Why do they believe it? What are the events that shaped how their worldview was formed? And what does that mean for an inevitable future where millennials are in charge? And I'm not arguing, as I said in the introduction of the book, you know, this book includes a lot of people like Pete Buttigieg and AOC and new members of Congress like Lauren Underwood and even a couple Republicans like Dan Crenshaw and Elise Stefanik. I'm not arguing that those people will be president, or that, you know, Pete Buttigieg is going to be the next president, AOC is going to be the next, you know, Speaker of the House. That's not what I'm arguing here. The point is that by looking at their lives and at the major events that influenced how they came to their political positions and how they think about American government, many other people their age experienced those similar events and came to similar conclusions. So there is a whole different attitude that this generation has. And by the way, it's not just this generation. Every generation has their own set of attitudes and assumptions that are informed by the events of their early adulthood. So I was just looking at what those events and those attitudes and assumptions are for millennials, who are now the largest block of eligible voters and, you know, really poised to make a huge impact on our national politics.
Mm-hmm. And this thing that you mentioned there about you went back to figure out how their political views, their worldviews were formed. What were the events? This idea of events that impact us when we're young is really kind of an important linchpin in the way you approach this. Can you talk just a bit about that?
Absolutely, yeah. So there's a lot of research that suggests that that the events of early adulthood, specifically between like 14 and 28, give or take, you know, have a significantly bigger impact on lifelong political leanings than events that are experienced later in life. And it makes total sense that, you know, there aren't a lot of, that this is in some ways the period of political awakening in your life. And this is the first moment where many people start to think about, they become eligible to vote, they start thinking about where they want to live and raise a family, they start paying taxes. This phase of sort of late teens into mid-20s is when young people join the adult world. And part of that is, you know, figuring out their politics. And so this research has shown that events experienced in that period have roughly three times the impact on lifelong political attitudes as events experienced later. And that, importantly, popular presidents tend to attract young people to their party, and unpopular presidents tend to repel young people from their party. So that means it's almost a little bit more complicated than all boomers are this, all Gen Xers are that, all millennials are like this, because in fact you could have somebody who turned 18 under, let's say, Dwight D. Eisenhower, who was a very popular Republican president. A lot of people, you know, thought he was good for the country. He was a war hero. He was building highways. He was, you know, had a happy smile on his face. If you turned 18 in an Eisenhower presidency, you were more likely to lean Republican for the rest of your life than if you turned 18 during, let's say, a Nixon presidency. So that is, and often those cohorts don't necessarily line up exactly with generations, although there's obviously significant overlap.
Yeah, no, I've thought about this myself. I was in 11th grade algebra class when the news came over the school PA that JFK had been shot.
Yep, and I'm sure that was a major event for you, right?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And I remember thinking before Kennedy's election that a president was someone like Eisenhower, older, reserved, you know, it was just, that was, you know, for, he was president for 8 years from the time I was, let me see, in 60, I was 12. So from the time I was four to the time I was 12, he was what a president was. And then Kennedy, of course, changed the entire image to me of what a president could be. And then the assassination, you know, has the effect it has. Start the book with 9/11, and say that where were you when you experienced 9/11 is, you know, analogous to where was I when Kennedy got shot, or as I imagine, you know, where were you when you learned of Pearl Harbor for my parents? So where were you and where were some of the folks in the book?
So I was in seventh grade Spanish class. And I remember really clearly that we heard about 9/11 over the loudspeaker, and we were about to take a quiz, and then my teacher made us take the quiz anyway.
Yeah, that sticks in your mind.
Yeah, and I was like, why am I taking this quiz? We're, you know, experiencing a terrorist attack. I grew up in New Jersey, so I remember also that you could see and smell the smoke from where I lived in New Jersey. And you could, there was like a high point in our town, like up on a mountain, and you could go up and see the billows of smoke coming out from downtown Manhattan. And, you know, the figures that I highlight in the book, most of them had a fairly similar type of experience. They were in school. They heard about it. School was interrupted. You know, one of my characters, Elise Stefanik, you know, she grew up in upstate New York, which is where she currently represents in Congress. She had a friend whose sister worked in the World Trade Center and, you know, immediately thought that her sister had died. And that was a very traumatic experience for her. And it turns out that the sister was okay, thank God. What most of these people described, which is, I think, what is true for a lot of millennials, is that 9/11 was the moment that millennials realized that the U.S. was part of the world, right? And there was a rupture, because this kind of sense of peace and security that a lot of kids had grown up with in the 1990s, when a lot of U.S. foreign policy was focused on things happening really far away in Bosnia and Czechoslovakia that, like, don't affect kids, right? Or don't affect American kids. It didn't seem to affect American kids. Suddenly that was over. And one of the things that I've been thinking about a lot now that we're in the era of coronavirus is that one good shorthand for understanding which events will stick out in the minds of American kids as major historical events for them is what gets school canceled. you know, I mean,
yes.
a school shooting in your region certainly does that.
A major
hurricane in your state certainly does that. 9/11, I mean, school was canceled some places, but other places it was interrupted all over the country, right? And I definitely think that coronavirus is going to be that for for the kids right now. I mean, they've been out of school for months, and they'll probably be out of school for even longer.
Yeah, in some ways, in terms of a rupture, those other ones were a day, 2 days, 3 days. With ripple effects, perhaps. This, yeah. if I think about it, I mean, and I hadn't really, you know, what it's like for kids to suddenly not have school and have their life totally changed for we don't know how long.
Yeah, no, exactly. And you know, one, I think this is always like important for people to understand how really young people, you know, like a seventh grader, mm-hmm. Understands things differently than an adult. You know, most 10-year-olds, 12-year-olds, 15-year-olds, no matter how smart they are not paying really close attention to, oh my God, you know, Barack Obama and John Kerry negotiated the Iran nuclear deal. No, even something that might be on the cover, on the front page of the New York Times as a major global event, like, I think the Iran nuclear deal is a good example of the type of thing that's a major global event that an ordinary kid probably is not paying that much attention
right.
to. Right.
Yeah.
Things that get school canceled or things that come over the loudspeaker in school, those really stick out in kids' minds. And they help to begin to draw the contours of how young people think about government. And those first impressions matter a lot.
Yeah, you know, as you were talking, I was thinking when I was not seventh grade, but high school, let's say, we did have the draft. So mm-hmm. the Vietnam War was more real for young people than I think Iraq and Afghanistan have been, unless you're in certain communities and certain families. I think also the Cold War, the missile crisis in 62, and those things told us that we were part of the larger world in a way that I think you're right. Prior to 9/11, you could, and of course the pandemic is something the whole globe is going through, but prior to 9/11, I think it was pretty easy to not ever see that.
Right. Right, yeah. Definitely.
Yeah. So you also, and I do want to talk just briefly about this. I confess I have not, I don't have children of my own. I have a stepson who's in grad school now, and I've been in his life since 12. And he was probably just kind of wrapping up Harry Potter when I came into his life. And I haven't read any Harry Potter, but you point out that Harry Potter has a big influence.
Yeah. I mean, so Harry Potter is... not only the most popular children's book of, you know, the early 2000s, it's the most popular children's book of all time. It is arguably no other work of art in human history has been consumed by as many people at the time that it was being created as Harry Potter was. Not Dickens, not Shakespeare, not the Bible. We're not talking about cumulatively over centuries. We're talking about the year that it was written. Nothing has eclipsed Harry Potter's influence. And it's really important to think about, to understand what this means. Because, first of all, this was a book at a time when a lot of kids were playing video games and watching television. And there was a proliferation of screens and computer games and all kinds of things that were new and very exciting to kids. So curling up with a book was actually not a relatively unusual experience, but we do know that kids in the 90s and early 2000s did a little bit less reading than kids who didn't have video games to play with.
Sure.
This had an unbelievable impact because every kid read this book or saw the movies, and if they didn't, they knew about them. There were no kids who did not know about Harry Potter or did not know who Hermione Granger was, right?
Although you point out Dan Crenshaw was not into Harry Potter.
Yeah, but
he couldn't
of
escape
course.
It though, right?
Yeah, you still couldn't escape it. You didn't have to read it to understand it. And at its fundamental, and by the way, it's not actually, you know, we can get to that later. That's not a huge coincidence because one thing that I cite this research from the University of Vermont that found that kids who were really into Harry Potter and kids who were fans of Harry Potter tended to be significantly more progressive than kids who weren't. And that's because this is a book that's all about authoritarianism. It's about kids banding together to resist an authoritarian leader who wants to create a racially pure elite society, right? Ring a bell?
Wow.
It's about it deals with themes of like of intense sympathy for outsiders, ostracization, racial purity, like I said before, and also torture is something that is a major, major theme in Harry Potter. And in fact, one of the things that this research found was that kids who read Harry Potter tended to have significantly lower approval for torture, even when it's necessary, or torture even to, you know, get answers or something like mm-hmm. that. So when you think about the fact that this is a book that carries these themes in a really compelling way, right? And also that almost every kid in this generation read this book, and not only read it once, read it 7 times, right? And
yeah.
then watched 7 movies.
Yeah.
So the impact of that is tremendous in terms of how these young people thought about their moral universe and thought about what their responsibility within that universe might be.
Yeah, I wonder whether an older person, a boomer or, you know, in between or whatever, writing the same book would have realized the influence of Harry Potter.
I don't know.
You know?
Yeah, like I also think that, you know, I am always a little skeptical of people of particularly older people writing about younger people in ways that tell them what to do. Like, for example, this is a little bit of an aside, but
sure.
After the Parkland shooting, I wrote a big story about those kids,
mm-hmm.
and I heard from a lot of very kind, very well-meaning boomers who were like, you know, I want to write a book about how kids can fight for, you know, gun safety. And I'm like, they don't need your help. Like, they're doing fine. Like, they do not need your advice.
That's right.
You,
like, they call the march you just marched in.
Yeah, exactly. Right, exactly. So, I do kind of think that there are some sort of cultural touchstones that you only understand if you're in the generation.
Right. Let me tell people, this is Free Forum, a world that just might work. I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking with Charlotte Alter. She's a national correspondent for Time Magazine, and we're talking about the ideas and the people in her first book, The Ones We've Been Waiting For, How a New Generation of Leaders Will Transform America. And you can learn more and find a lot of her great journalistic work, profiles of a lot of these folks, and of, as we just talked about, the March for Our Lives people. She did the recent cover story on the Person of the Year, Greta Thunberg. And you can find all of that at charlottealter.com. Charlotte, and then Alter, all one word, charlottealter.com. You cite Trump's election as, you know, one of these significant events. And one of the things you say is that you were told it couldn't happen by the experts, by the press. And you say it upset young people's trust of journalism. This is a bit of an aside, but I had a similar reaction to the 2008 crash that exposed the experts, the adults,
right.
whether in Wall Street or Washington, as really not knowing what they were doing and not to be trusted with our lives and no control over what really mattered. And I predicted at that point that loss of trust in the folks in charge would break down some of the accepted myths that had little basis in reality, but had just hung on for years. And I suggested then that you look, and in the next few years, we'll pass gay marriage, we'll legalize marijuana, and we'll get universal health care. Because, you know, they'd been third rail issues for no damn reason.
Right.
And suddenly people said, well, just because they say they're third rail, they don't know what's going on. And I was right about two out of three mm-hmm. and partially right about the third. What was the effect of Trump's election in, you know, overall and then in terms of this relationship to the media and journalism?
So I think that you make a really good point about 2008. And in some ways, I think that the reaction to Trump's election was part of a broader disillusionment, because you have to look at it in context of all the other things that millennials had already seen by the time Trump was elected. So go back to the war in Iraq and Afghanistan, mm-hmm. which completely demolished trust in America's foreign policy establishment, right? Because they had said that there were weapons of mass destruction, and guess what? There weren't, right? And 20 years later, we're still fighting, okay? So this generation saw the collapse of the credibility of the American foreign policy establishment. Then in 2008, they saw the collapse of credibility in the financial establishment, because all of these, you know, bankers had said that, you know, our economy was healthy and that these bundled loans were going to be fine. And then guess what? They weren't, you know? And so in some ways, Trump's election was the third shoe to fall. I guess not many people have three shoes, but like, you know, it was, you know, they had already been let down by the foreign policy establishment. They had already been let down by the economic establishment. Now they were being let down by the American political establishment. All of these experts and people who said with total certainty that Donald Trump could not be elected to be president of the United States. So I think what, you know, we've seen two contrasting but in some ways complementary results from that disillusionment. On the one hand, you've seen some millennials who just have been completely turned off by public life entirely and are just like, for lack of a better word, screw everything. I'm out of here. Like this, you know, I don't trust anybody or anything. Which frankly is a completely rational and reasonable reaction to mm-hmm. the events of their lives. You know, why should they trust anybody or anything? They've never been given any real reason to. But then the other side of that, there, of course, were some millennials who said, you know what, if the grownups have utterly failed at leading this country, then I'm going to step up and try to do something about it myself and build a better world in the ashes of the old one, for lack of a better phrase. And so I think those are the people that my book is about. There's a completely other book to be written about the disillusioned millennials, you know, because I'm not arguing that every millennial is a stepper upper like the ones in this book.
Right.
But I just was focused specifically on electeds.
Right. I mean, there's kind of three groups, right? There's the disaffected. There's the activists that are you know, beyond, you know, have a different approach to how they're going to fix things, but you, as you said, chose the electeds.
Yes.
And let's talk just a bit. I know we're talking more about the big ideas, the trends, those sorts of things. Just a few of let people know some of the people that you talk about in this book that you spent time with, and throw in, if you will, that thing that I mentioned, which is that because you were not going the path that so many other journalists were of focusing on the White House and outrage and the reaction, even focusing on the resistance to the White House and so on, you were out crossing the country meeting these people. So when I say you got to someone early, what does that mean?
So what that means is that, for example, you know, Haley Stevens, who's somebody who ran and won a seat in Congress in 2018 from Michigan, or Lauren Underwood in Illinois. I went and spoke with them before they won their primaries. And normally before people win their primaries, they are much less guarded because they're much more open and candid. They're just normal people. I mean, Haley let me read her childhood journals, which you're really not supposed to do if you're going to be a congresswoman to a reporter, you know? And so I met them really early. I had been talking to Pete Buttigieg since 2017 when I first wrote a piece about millennial mayors that was in a lot of ways one of the seeds of this book,
Yeah,
because I
sure.
wrote this piece about cities that are run by millennials and what that can teach us about how millennials govern. AOC, this has been a source of a little confusion. I actually didn't speak to AOC until after she was elected, but I did once I did interview her. I spent a lot of time with her brother, and this is another kind of interesting reportorial tactic that I think is unique to millennials as well. I was able to find her personal Facebook and many, many hours of live video that had been posted to her personal Facebook because there was a period of time, this is a little bit of a deep cut, but there was a period of time like 2014 to 2017, basically, when Facebook, the company, was really pushing people to do these Facebook lives. And what that would mean would be that you would kind of live stream whatever you were doing, and then it would save to your Facebook. Right now, Instagram lives, they just disappear immediately, right? But these Facebook lives would save to your Facebook. So I found her and several other characters' Facebook lives from some of these major events that I was writing about. Like I found hers from her journey to Standing Rock. So I was able to recreate and I was able to describe in real detail this journey that she took because I had 12 hours of live video footage of exactly what happened, which is so much better than somebody saying, "Oh, well, it was a really fun trip."
Or even picking the two or three things they think stick out, which may be very different from what you find when you look at the full footage.
Exactly. Exactly. So,
They
it
don't get to
so
shape it for you.
they don't get to, in some ways, people's recollections can be really tricky. So one thing I really benefited from was that for several of these events that I'm talking about, that I write about in the book, they're based off of live video footage from the time, which is a little bit unique.
Yeah,
You don't
what you're
typically
saying is
have that.
Facebook Live still exists. It's still permanent, right? But young people just aren't using it.
And also, I mean, it definitely still exists. It definitely still saves to your Facebook, but it was part of the corporate strategy of Facebook in 2015 and 2016 and 2017 in a way that it's not really anymore. They were really pushing in their algorithm to get people to do it, and they kind of stopped
I
that.
remember, right? If you wanted to get, to get high in the feed or get people to see it, that's what the algorithm told you you had to do. While we're talking about that, actually, you point out an interesting thing, which is that you look at someone like Pete Buttigieg, like Ocasio-Cortez, like Dan Crenshaw, the Republican congressman with the eye patch who lost his eye in Afghanistan, who is a Republican and a rising star. That they have a quite a polished media persona right out of the box because of this experience. Talk about that.
So it's something that I think has been thrown into even sharper relief when you look at, for example, the Joe Biden campaign, right? So, somebody like AOC, who has been using Facebook Live and taking photos, taking selfies, and doing Instagram stories and all kinds of things, nobody ever had to teach AOC how to talk to a camera. Nobody had to teach her how to formulate her thoughts succinctly. And that was one of the things that I got to watch as I was watching these old Facebook videos of her. I got to watch her morph from an ordinary person into somebody who has a political presence, right? And that comes from being a digital native. It comes from throughout your adolescence and early adulthood, using tools that require you to essentially package your identity into things that can be consumed online, whether it's writing a Facebook post or hosting a digital part, sending out an invitation to a party, like a Facebook group, or you want people to come and you have to tell people why, to doing video, to doing any number of things that like require fluency in digital communication, right? And so basically, watching somebody like Joe Biden, who did not grow up doing that and doesn't have that fluency, he's at a real disadvantage. And it's one of the big challenges for his campaign, because you can even see with his digital content right now, he does not know, he does not have an instinct for what works on the internet.
Wow. And I mean, Trump, because of his years as a reality TV star, not quite the same, but he got the practice, you know, of what a successful take looked like in all those years, which gave him the advantage over other politicians.
Exactly. I mean, Trump, you know, even though he's a boomer, even though he was born in the 1940s, he does have an intuitive grasp of the internet and what works online and what goes viral. And importantly for his campaign, his campaign manager is Brad Parscale,
yes,
who was his digital, who is a millennial, who was his digital director in 2016, and he really understands the internet.
Yeah, no, so, I thought that was very interesting and showed, you know, some was a real savvy move that the person who did digital last time, and there was that long New Yorker article about mm-hmm. Pascal and his story and how, you know, it was. They didn't know the thing, you know, that led them to lean on digital so much was lack of money. But that he right. gets elevated to campaign manager shows they understand where the power is. Do you think that I saw you asked about some of the ways politics is going to change. And one of the ways you said was about what we're talking about, that there's almost a celebrity about these people, mm-hmm. AOC, Crenshaw, and so on. And do you think that also means that they will be better at story and narrative?
Yeah. I mean, I think that in some ways, celebrity and, you know, that those are almost two sides of the same coin. The people who are really compelling the characters, frankly, mm-hmm. are often the ones who know how to spin stories around themselves. And that's a really, really important part of modern campaigning that I think, whereas I think in earlier times, you could kind of get away with being like, hey, I'm a smart legislator. I made this great law. Vote for me. that doesn't cut it anymore.
Although I would say the stars have almost always been the storytellers. I'd say two things. The America loves aspirational optimists.
Yes.
And they love storytellers. And, you know, Trump versus Clinton was just a complete mismatch on that grounds. Mm-hmm. Obama was a good storyteller. Clinton was a great storyteller.
Yes.
I mean, until the Man from Hope film right. by the folks who were TV producers, successful TV producers, that transformed his candidacy.
Right. Well, I think you're absolutely right. And I think what the point is here is that the mechanism for storytelling has changed.
Yes.
You know, it used to be like your storytelling was in your stump speech.
Yeah.
And now people have to be constantly feeding the story of themselves. You know, AOC spending her time during the coronavirus outbreak, you know, delivering food to people in her mm-hmm. District, that is part of her story. And I do think that there's there's a way that people can create their online persona that is very kind of aligned with this sort of storytelling skill. And it's going to be interesting to watch how that develops.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit about one of the things, what for you explains the millennials and youngers' passion for Bernie Sanders and lukewarm response to Pete Buttigieg?
So I think there's a couple things. One is that Bernie Sanders, in some ways, the love for Bernie and the, for lack of a better word, suspicion of Pete are part of the same thing, but in some ways they're actually kind of different from each other. So the love for Bernie Sanders, I think, comes from, one, this is a guy who is talking clearly about the major problems that millennials have faced in their lifetimes, which are what I lay out in my book. Student debt, An economy that has changed in a way where young people can no longer count on government-sponsored health insurance. A climate that is threatening to leave the planet unlivable for our kids and grandkids. A criminal justice system that is racist and unjust and unfairly traps young Black men and ruins their lives, right? So he's talking about that in a really robust way. And I think one of the things that's important to understand about this is that it's not just that Bernie Sanders was talking about it, because one of the things we saw in 2020 was that, you know, since Bernie's 2016 campaign, a lot of people had been talking about it. He wasn't the only person talking about a Green New Deal. He wasn't the only person talking about student debt. In fact, almost the whole field was talking about the things that he was talking about, right? But what Bernie had is that he had the anger about it, and he had the rage about it, and he had the
incredible authenticity also.
Yes. The way I was going to put it was intolerance for bullshit.
Yes.
And one of the things that I think is interesting about Pete is that he is by nature not a rageful person.
Yeah.
He is not angry. He is not confrontational. It's not what his personality is like. And so I think that many millennials thought of Pete as sort of inauthentic,
yeah,
when actually he wasn't being inauthentic. Right. It's just he has a different personality. The other thing to remember about Pete, particularly when it comes to inauthenticity, which is, I think, you know, a lot of millennials kind of thought, oh, he's robotic. He looks like he was cooked up in a lab. He's like Mr. Robot, like whatever.
Yeah.
And they thought he was too goody-goody kind of.
Mm-hmm.
And listen, like I, you know, have been talking to him for 3 years. I've interviewed his mother, his friends, his college roommates, his high school friends, his middle school friends, his high school teachers, his husband, his staff, like anybody who's ever known him, who I could find, I talked to. He has always been like that. This is
that
his
is that is Pete Buttigieg. That's not a that is, manufactured that Pete Buttigieg. Him. That's him.
That's him. It's not manufactured. It is his personality.
And as you point out, he was in the closet for, as you say, since he was three or something. So
yeah,
so
he
learned to be who he was.
Yeah, and I think that you cannot divorce that kind of guarded, practiced personality from the fact that this is somebody who for 30 years of his life had to construct an identity around himself in order to hide his sexuality.
Yeah.
So this is all part of it. But the other thing I want to say about Pete Buttigieg and Bernie Sanders is that in some ways, you know, even though the left and progressives really hated on Pete Buttigieg a lot because they considered him to be too moderate, in some ways he is the best evidence of their success. Because the fact that, you know, if Pete Buttigieg was one of the moderates in this race, if he was, you know, standing at the center.
That's right.
And this is somebody who wanted radical government action on climate change, wanted to create a public option, wanted massive student loan forgiveness from the federal government. Those are all things, like, if the person in the center is asking for those things, that means that the progressives have really successfully swung the center of gravity to the left.
Yeah.
And it's like, yes, I know that he's not as far as they want him to go, but a centrist in the 1990s never would have taken the positions that a centrist in 2020 is and has.
Yeah.
And
there's,
so that
nerdy
is,
political concept of the Overton window. Right?
Exactly.
That you move, if you move everything, then the center moves and the extremes move. And yes, he is certainly to the left of Obama.
Significantly to the left of Obama.
Exactly. I have been playing around myself with a notion that a lot of the values and visions and so on that emerged in the 60s are alive again in young people, the best of the 60s, you know, not the excesses but the or the foolishness, but the best, the community, justice, civil rights, anti-war, consumption isn't everything, don't trust the leaders, all those sorts of things. And I see them alive in younger people, and I see three things that give younger people an advantage over us. I came out of college in 1969. First, technology, and notwithstanding the challenge of surveillance capitalism as practiced by big tech, but, you know, organizing the airport demonstrations against the initial Trump travel ban were organized in a day, and it took 4 months to organize, you know, the moratorium against the war in Vietnam. They're connected. You can be alone in a small town in Iowa and think nobody thinks like me back when I was there. Now you know that you're part of a larger community. Mm-hmm. In the 60s, except for 100 beatniks in San Francisco and 100 in Greenwich Village, young people with these values were sort of on their own. And I know that's not quite true, because the leaders, whether it was Bobby Kennedy or Martin Luther King or, you know, et cetera, Gloria Steinem, were a bit older. But for the most part, whereas now there is, I think, among all the older generations, sympathy and enthusiasm for some of the same values. And third, and this is one that I think is crucial, is that in the 60s, almost all the leadership was male. If it was a black group, it was black males. If it was a white group, it was white males. And no one was out of the closet, and et cetera, et cetera. And so the talent pool now is just so much greater. And I sort of say, you know, two words, Greta Thunberg, right? A 15-year-old kid from, this would never have happened then. So any thoughts you have about that notion? And my goal in thinking about that is there an alliance possible rather than a generational war?
Yes, I mean, I certainly think that there's an alliance possible rather than a generational war. But what I, and I think that you made some really good points, and I agree with most of what you said. I think that the challenge is that the central challenge that I've noticed between boomers and millennials who are politically aligned, right? Or, you know, who are both liberal, where it's not like millennial Bernie supporters versus boomer Trump supporters. The central challenge I've noticed is that, and again, this is, I think, largely a very understandable function of age, right? Is that when there is alignment, I still see a lot of boomers telling millennials how it should be.
Ah.
You know? Well, we did this in the 60s. We know better because we've been around for longer. You don't know about this. You don't know about that. And like, listen, they could be right. I'm not trying to call the shots on who's right, who's wrong here. But what I am saying is that a huge part of this generational tension is that millennials are a little bit like, take a seat. Mm. You had your shot. You had 50 years to you had 50 years of political relevance in this country where your ideas were at the center of the national conversation. It's our turn. And so even if there is agreement on the issues, even if there is agreement on some of the tactics, even if there's agreement on the candidate or who, you know, I think what millennials are saying is that it's our turn now. You had your time. And that even if there is alignment and largely, you know, an agreement between the generations that it should be centered on the future rather than the past. And I think that that's the central argument that many millennials are making.
Mm-hmm. Okay, fair enough. We've got to bring this to a close. So let me tell people again, the book is The Ones We've Been Waiting For. The website is charlottealter.com. That's one word, charlottealter, A-L-T-E-R.com. For this conversation and many other interviews and articles, and to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to terrencemcnally.net or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same website. If you want to receive my weekly email announcement of guests and issues, plus 8 to 10 articles that I choose each week to flesh out the conversation, sign up at my site or email me at temcnally@mac.com, T-E-M-C-N-A-L-L-Y. You can also subscribe and listen to the Freeform podcast on Apple Podcasts, iTunes, and at most other podcast sites. And you can find years of podcasts at my site. Michael Lewis, Jeremy Scahill, Naomi Klein, Robert Reich, Van Jones, Connie Rice. You can also follow me on Twitter, at McNally Terrence. Thanks to G. Lee and Mark Maxwell in Productions, George Vassilopoulos at Progressive Voices. Most of all, you, my listeners, please share this podcast widely. And thank you, Charlotte Alter. Keep up your good work.
Thank you so much for having me, Terrence. This was so fun.